Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on hyperinflation when we come back. You know Charles Lyell? He's one of the pillars of modern geology. He published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe in these concepts, these evolutionary principles, don't even know who it was that originated these ideas. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins was devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. And in that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood have been strictly ruled out. And this process is called science. Well, listen to this. The sun is shrinking. Now, that's a newswire report reported in the newspaper. And it made this surprising statement. It said, the sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. Scientists have been watching for over 100 years now, and the evidence is conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by about 5 feet. Now, if the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then that totals 1% per millennium. That's 1,000 years. So if the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. So if we count back 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth 93 million miles in diameter. And as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origin of the sun. Billions and billions of years ago, they tell us. But what did our teachers teach us about the dinosaur extinction? Do you remember that? That was about 65 million years ago. 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs were roaming around on the Earth. But 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun was 93 million miles in diameter and touching the orbit of the Earth. Now, you know, kids, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on these kinds of pseudo-scientific lies. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the guise of science. And it's one of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I conduct twice a year here in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, informative, it's entertaining. And best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, and then just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about hyperinflation. Last time, talking about hyperinflation, I mentioned to you the Figge Report. Figge Report. And in that report, they pointed out that down in Bolivia in 1985, they had a hyperinflation down there. 1,500% inflation rate means carrying a suitcase instead of a wallet for your money. Well, in November of 1984, this little short article appeared in the newspaper. It said that a host handed the waiter two tightly packed wads weighing about a pound each, a pound of 50 peso notes to pay for dinner. a dinner for four the other night. The tab, $21.78 American, or 200,000 pesos in Bolivian money. Such an unwieldy transaction is common in Bolivia these days, reflecting one of the more tangible problems posed by rampant inflation in South America's poorest country. Now, isn't that just real special? But what causes 1,500% inflation in Bolivia? Is it the people counterfeiting money? Are there thousands of peons and truck drivers and soccer moms that are out there running basement printing presses and printing all this money? Where does the money come from that causes all of this inflation? And who wants all of that inflation anyway? Is it Sally Soccer Mom or Joe Sixpack that wants all of this inflation? Or is it somebody else that wants the inflation and Joe Sixpack and Sally Soccer Mom are just bystanders watching it all go by? Well, the 7th President of the United States, Andrew Jackson, had something to say about bankers, and he called them a den of vipers. Now, vipers are poisonous snakes. Our 7th president, who was also a general, didn't think much of bankers. I don't know what he thought of preachers or politicians. I don't know what he thought of others in the professional world, like doctors and dentists and so on, but he didn't have much use for bankers. Now, I noticed that Jesus of Nazareth didn't have much to say in a good light about bankers, preachers, or lawyers. And in Luke chapter 11, verse 37 through 54, Jesus had some very uncomplimentary things to say about preachers, number one, lawyers, number two, and then in another section of Scripture, bankers, number three. Three of the more venerated professions here in America: preachers, lawyers, and bankers. They're looked up to. Well, they're looked up today in 2006. People look at their banker, wow, look at that guy. He's our local banker. Now, where I live, our local banker's name is John Harlan. Very nice fella. I see him over at the restaurant quite often. He goes out to Amex's, you know, at the fish farm and has dinner. And when I go out there to dinner, and once in a while, I run across John Harlan, the local banker. And he kind of hobnobs with the preachers and the lawyers around the local area. Well, Andrew Jackson had this to say about the vipers. In 1828, when Andrew Jackson was campaigning for the presidency, he was opposed to the central banking system. And during his campaign, he told the bankers that you are a den of vipers and I intend to rout you out. And by the eternal God, I will rout you out. And he also stated that if the people only understood the bank and the rank injustice of the banks and the money system, the banking system, there would be a revolution before morning. That's paragraph one. 7th President of the United States, Andrew Jackson. He said, if you people out there understood banking, you would revolt against your government. Now, we don't have any revolutions against government. We certainly don't have any revolutions against our government concerning banks, money, and banking. Americans are very satisfied with the banking system, as evidenced by the fact that they all have mortgages on their homes, and they go to the banks to borrow the money to buy their automobiles, and they have consumer debt and credit cards. In fact, we conduct more transactions, more dollar transactions with our credit cards issued by the banks than we do with the money issued by our government. So, to say that Americans are disenchanted with the banks, banking, and the money system in 2006 is a fiction. Now, during his inauguration message, Jackson said that the federal constitution must be obeyed, states' rights preserved, our national debt must be paid, direct taxes and loans avoided, and the federal union preserved. And these are the objects that I have in view, and regardless of all consequences, I intend to carry into effect. Now, that's something that our President George Bush does not believe in. So our current President George Bush and our seventh President Andrew Jackson, whose picture you'll find on the $20 Federal Reserve note, they didn't see eye to eye. And if Jackson were alive today, I don't think that he would approve of George Bush's policies. The supporters of the bank called themselves the National Republicans, which later became the Whig Party. They nominated Henry Clay for president and John Sargent, a member of the bank's legal staff, for vice president. Now, President Jackson believed that the people, by reelecting him, had expressed their opinion that he should break the power of what he called this hydra of corruption, the second bank of the United States. And on July 10, 1832, President Jackson presented to the Senate his veto message on rechartering the Bank of the United States. Now, here are some of the statements that he made in his veto message to the Senate. He said, "Having considered the bill with solemn regard to the principles of the Constitution, I come to the conclusion that it ought not to become a law, and some of the powers and privileges possessed by the existing bank are unauthorized by the Constitution. They are subversive to the rights of the states and dangerous to the liberties of the people, and it enjoys an exclusive privilege of banking under the authority of the federal government, a monopoly of its favor and support, and as a necessary consequence, almost a monopoly of the foreign and domestic exchange." Now, that's what we approved in 1913 with the Federal Reserve Bank. That's what President Wilson and the Congress of the United States and every Congress since 1914 and every president has supported, this Federal Reserve. President Jackson said that he came to the conclusion that it ought not to become a law. So obviously, in the later years, we Americans came to the conclusion that Jackson was wrong, and we wanted to fix his mistake. The God of Abraham held to this same view. Our founding fathers in 1787 held this view of banks and banking, and they gave us gold and silver coin, and our God commanded us to use gold and silver coin and told us not to use unjust weights and balances. Now, obviously, we Americans of the modern age of 2006 can see the stupidity and the ignorance of our seventh president, of our first six presidents, of Thomas Jefferson, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution of the United States were all wrong, and we had to fix those in 1914 with the Federal Reserve Act. And, of course, it goes without saying that our God was kind of stupid, and he didn't know what was going on either. The Act seems to be predicated on the erroneous idea that the present stockholders have a prescriptive right to not only the favor, but to the bounty of government for their benefit. Does this act exclude the whole American people from competition in the purchase of this monopoly? Now, the Federal Reserve is a monopoly that the rest of us are barred from. And these 13 bankers of the Federal Reserve, these 13 chief stockholders of the Bank of International Settlements, have that privilege, that monopoly today. He went on to say that if the bank were rechartered in perpetuity, the present stockholders and those inheriting their rights as successors in interest would be established as a privileged order, clothed both with great political power and enjoying immense pecuniary advantages from their connection with government. And that's exactly where the banks and the multinational corporations are today. And that's why we have 36,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C., buying and purchasing and bribing our Congress and our president. But Jackson went on to say, should its influence become concentrated, as it may, under the operation of such an act as this, in the hands of a self-elected directory, whose interests are identified with those of the foreign stockholders, will there not be cause to tremble for the independence of our country in war? Their power would be great whenever they might choose to exert it. Now, we're in war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that war is directed by these central bankers, and we are at their mercy. Should the stock of the bank principally pass into the hands of the subjects of a foreign country, what would be our condition? All its operation would be in aid of the hostile fleets of armies without. And by the way, all of those stockholders of the Federal Reserve of the United States are foreigners. They're all Europeans. Now, controlling our currency, receiving our public monies, and withholding and holding thousands of our citizens in dependence, it would be more formidable and dangerous than the naval and military power of an enemy navy. It is maintained by some, however, that the bank is a means of exercising the constitutional power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. Congress has established a mint to coin money and passed laws to regulate the value thereof. The money so coined, with its value so regulated, and such foreign coins as the Congress may adopt, are the only currency known to our Constitution. Boys and girls, we have that restored. We have gold and silver coin. And then we have Federal Reserve notes and commercial paper. And we are not bound to use commercial paper. We can use our own gold and silver coins. We've had them since 1986. We Americans don't use them. We prefer banks and unjust weights and balances, commercial paper and mortgages, usury and interest. But we don't have to, and we're not being forced to. And if we're using that commercial paper and those Federal Reserve notes, we do so with our own free will and volition. He went on to say, but if they, the Congress, have the power to regulate the currency, it was conferred to be exercised by themselves and not to be transferred to a private corporation. Well, if in 1836 it wasn't intended to be transferred to a private corporation, then why did we transfer that power to a private corporation in 1914? Well, obviously, then it must be conceded that President Jackson was in error, the Founding Fathers were in error, and our God must have been in error, and we corrected those three errors in 1914 when we established the Federal Reserve Act. He went on to say that if the bank be established for that purpose with a charter, unalterable without its consent, Congress have parted with its power for a term of years, during which the Constitution is a dead letter. Well, boys and girls, if the President said it was a dead letter, if he were to sign this act and he vetoed it, has the Constitution become a dead letter under the Federal Reserve Act of 1914? It is neither necessary nor proper to transfer its legislative power to such a bank, and therefore it is unconstitutional. Boys and girls, if it was unconstitutional in 1836, did it become constitutional in 1914? And if so, how did that occur? It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful of our nation too often bend the acts of government to their selfish purposes. In the full enjoyments of the gifts of heaven and the fruits of superior industry, economy, and virtue, every man in America is equally entitled to protection by law. But when the laws undertake to add to those natural and just advantages artificial distinctions, to grant titles, gratuities and gratitudes, or exclusive privileges to make the rich richer and the potent more powerful, the humble members of society, the farmers, the mechanics, and the laborers, who have neither the time nor the means of securing favors to themselves, have a right to complain of the injustice of their government. There are no necessary evils in government. Its evils exist only in its abuses. And if government could confine itself to equal protection, and as heaven does its rain, shower its favors alike upon the high and the low, the rich and the poor, it would be an unqualified blessing. In the Banking Act before me, there seems to be a wide and an unnecessary departure from these principles. Nor is our government to be maintained or our union preserved by invasions of the rights and powers of the several states. In thus attempting to make our government strong, we make it weak. Its true strength consists in leaving individuals and states as much as is possible alone and to themselves, in making itself felt not in its power, but in its beneficence, not in its control, but in its protection, not in its binding the states more closely to the center, but in leaving each state to move unobstructed in its own proper orbit. Experience should teach us wisdom. Most of the difficulties that our government now encounters, and most of the dangers which impend over our union, have sprung from an abandonment of the legislative and the legitimate objects of government by our national legislature and the adoption of such principles as are embodied in this Banking Act. Many of our rich men have not been content with equal protection and equal benefits, but rather they have besought us to make them richer by these acts of Congress. And it is time to pause in our career to review our principles and, if possible, to revive that devoted patriotism which distinguished the sages of the Revolution and the fathers of our nation. If we cannot at once, in justice to interests invested under improvident legislation, make our government want and what it ought to be, we can at least take a stand against all new grants of monopolies and exclusive privileges, such as rechartering a private bank of issue, against any prostitution of our government to the advancement of the few at the expense of the many, and in favor of compromises and gradual reform of our code of laws and system of political economy. Did you hear the word prostitution? He called the bankers prostitutes. Whores. Well, then that's not surprising. That's what Jesus called them. Except that Jesus was a little bit broader with his paintbrush. He called the preachers, the lawyers, and the bankers all prostitutes, hypocrites. He called them. I have now done my duty to my country in vetoing this measure. Compilation of the messages and papers of the presidents by James Richardson and a representative from Tennessee, published by authority of Congress. Volume 2, pages 576 to 591. Well, President Jackson had an embittered battle on his hands in order to accomplish what he set out to do. He decided to withdraw government money from the bank to pay current expenses and to deposit future government revenues in selected state banks. In 1834, the Senate passed a resolution of censure against Jackson, and Bank President Bedell, who had bribed the Senate heavily in order to get his resolution passed, said, "This worthy president thinks that because he has scalped Indians and imprisoned judges, that he is to have his way with the bank. Well, he is mistaken." There ensued a struggle for power between the bank and the executive branch of government in which the bankers lost. This struggle was to prove that President Jackson was correct in his statements that a private monopoly bank independent of government regulation should not be entrusted with the public finances. In 1836, the Second Bank of the United States passed out of existence when its charter expired, and during his presidency, Andrew Jackson fulfilled his campaign and inaugural promise. The federal constitution must be obeyed, states' rights preserved, our national debt must be paid, direct taxes and loans avoided, and the federal union preserved. These are the objects that I have in view, and regardless of all consequences, will carry into effect. Now, for the first and only time in the history of our government, the national debt was reduced to zero. Now, that's more than we can say today. Now, in order for us to understand this hyperinflation in the context of banks issuing credit, banks issuing money, it is true that vesting in the hands of a private entity the power to issue fiat paper currency, as we have with our Federal Reserve today, gives to that private entity extraordinary power over not only the economy of a nation, but its society as well. While many constitutionalists are acutely aware of this fact, little discussion has been made concerning an important corollary to this power. Not only is the power to issue this fiat paper currency extremely important to the currency creators, but the ability to loan such currency into circulation at interest gives to them absolute and complete control of the economy, the nation, and the people. The issuing power probably would be absolutely useless unless the currency that was issued could be borrowed into circulation at interest by the users thereof. It is through this process of borrowing the currency into circulation that our creditors, the currency creators, the Federal Reserve Bank, wields complete and total power over the debtors, which fulfills this old maxim that the debtor is servant to the lender, the users of the currency. This inherent flaw in our currency system has not received adequate discussion or attention. And the most convenient method to demonstrate this inherent flaw of borrowing currency into circulation is a very simple example of a card game. So let us imagine five people sitting in a room. Four of these people desire to play a game of cards. Four of the five people in the room sit down at a card table, but although possessing the desire to play a game, it is noticed by all that they have no cards with which to play the game. Now, the fifth person in the room approaches the four players, and he notices their lack of cards. And this fifth person just so happens to have in his possession a deck of cards, which he acquired for less than 2 cents per card. Now, being a character of predatory nature, the fifth person offers to loan his cards to the four players upon stringent terms and conditions. This villain makes to the potential players the following proposal. He says, "I have here in my hands 52 cards, and I will loan each of you players 13 cards apiece. However, each of you players must execute and deliver to me a promissory note wherein you promise to repay me 13 cards plus one card in the way of interest within 1 hour, and in order to afford me protection that I will be paid in full at the end of 1 hour, each of you must give me a mortgage upon a certain part of your real and personal property. To this take-it-or-leave-it offer, each player agrees, and they each give to the fifth person the required promissory note and mortgage upon their real property in chattels. And the fifth player delivers 13 cards to each player, and upon obtaining the cards necessary to play, our four players engage in their game. However, When 1 hour has passed, the fifth person notifies the four players and demands payment of the notes. Each player still only possesses 13 cards apiece, and no player can repay the principal and interest due to the owner of the cards. The fifth person then forecloses upon each player and obtains possession of all of the pledged collateral, all of the real estate, and personal property. Now, boys and girls, this is why President Jackson said that if the people of America understood the terms and conditions under which they have undertook to borrow money into circulation and pledge their homes and farms and collateral into a Ponzi scheme in which you can never pay the interest because you've only been loaned the principal. Some people play the game and they can come back with 13 cards or 15 or 18 cards, but not everybody is a winner. For every winner, there has to be at least one loser, and all of the losers lose their property to the bank. And the longer we play in the game, the more certain that each and every player in the game of the Federal Reserve System is going to lose all of his property. Now, boys and girls, most of you over the last 5 years or so have gone to the banks and you have mortgaged your houses. And now you have adjustable rate mortgages on those homes. The bank is in control of the manufacturer of the currency. They're also in possession of the power to raise and lower interest rates. When the bank is ready, they will raise the interest rates. And as they raise the interest rates, they will raise the payments on those adjustable rate mortgages. Today you're paying $1,000 and 5%, and tomorrow you will be paying 8% and $2,000, and then they will hyperinflate and raise the interest rates to 10, 12, 15, 20% until you no longer can pay and they foreclose. Then, under the terms and conditions of the agreement, which is the debtor is servant to the lender will come to you and say, stick out your hand and take your mark. You are my servant. And you will stick out your hand and you will take the mark of the beast because you have no other alternative. Now, your founding fathers protected you from that in the Coinage Act of 1792, and in the provision in your Constitution at Article 1, Section 10 that said, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. In 1836, President Jackson vetoed the second U.S. National Bank. Obviously, our founding fathers and President Jackson didn't know what they were doing. Then there was a third entity, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who told us, thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag, and you shall make no covenants or contracts with these foreign and alien gods. Obviously, our God also did not know what he was talking about. So from these three authorities, President Jackson, our founding fathers, and our God, and in the documents, the scripture, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Declaration of Independence, and the Coinage Act of 1792, and the veto message to the Congress in 1836. These authorities and these documents evidently were not enough to teach us that banks, central banks, central bankers, and fiat currency, paper money, unjust weights and balances were bad for us. So, we adopted the Federal Reserve, stocks and bonds, interest, collateral, and commercial paper. And now we sit on the brink. Now we're ready to take the punishment and the penalties for our actions. We had a choice to make. We made our choice. And now comes the results of that choice. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you these timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective 7 days a week. And these sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we do cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review, or vice versa. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Hyperinflation. Inflation is a sustained increase in the aggregate price level, and hyperinflation is very high inflation. That's all we're dealing with here. We've already got inflation, and we've had inflation since 1933. It actually got started in a little more reasonable scale back in 1914, but from 1914 to 1932, things weren't too bad. But we had already inflated and gotten to the point where we could no longer pay our bills, and we needed to revalue gold, and we did. We raised its price from $20.67 to $35 an ounce. That was about a 60% inflation. 60%, right off the top. Then at $35 an ounce, we went ahead until 1971. We got to another place in our history when we couldn't pay our bills anymore, and we had to revalue gold again. This time, instead of setting a price for gold, we just stopped dealing in it. We stopped paying our bills with specie. The price of gold in relationship to paper dollars increased in value until 1980, when they finally reached $854 an ounce, and then settled back to something more reasonable around $300 an ounce until approximately the year 2000. From $300, it's now doubled to $600. It again tells us that we're at that point, that juncture, where we can no longer pay our bills, and we're about to have another revaluation. When this revaluation occurs, because of the economic circumstances that have devolved since 1971, And since all the nations of the world are on the same fiat currency and they're all relying upon the reserve currency, the United States dollar, everybody in the world is in the same boat. And America wields tremendous leverage against everybody else in the world. And everybody in the world so far has toed the mark. And everybody else in the world knows they're not going to get paid. We owe approximately $49 trillion, and we can't pay. And everybody knows we're not going to pay. So there's this gigantic default that's in the winds. A gigantic default. We're not going to pay those bills. When that default occurs, there's going to be repercussions. And hyperinflation is one of the repercussions that comes from it. War, famine, disease, instability, dictatorial government, these are all symptoms that come from a monetary system that has gone upside down. And when this monetary system goes upside down, it's going to be a wallop-a-loser. Or as they used to say where I'm from, a James Dandy wallop-a-loser. When? I don't know, I'm not a prophet. But like the Titanic sailing at 23 knots dead ahead into 5,000 square miles of icebergs, this is not the most prudent course of action. Now, our president is spending us to prosperity. He is giving us tax cuts, which are in reality tax increases. We're being advertised as tax cuts, but they're not tax cuts, they're tax increases. We're given hedonic CPI and PPI numbers, but these numbers are lies, they're not true. And the people that put these lies out from the Department of Labor know they're not true. It's been reported in the mainstream press that hedonics aren't true, they're not accurate, and they're not correct. And that the budget deficits aren't $350 billion a year, but if we used standard accounting practices, it would show that they're more in line with about $700 billion a year. More lies. These figures aren't true. For the purposes of the general public, it doesn't make any difference because they're not familiar with these numbers. And they're unable to make determinations as to the solution to the problem. It's not something new. It's been going on now for about 85 years, since 1914. So that being the case, it just shows that democracy doesn't work. Bottom line, democracy doesn't work because the electorate is unable to steer the economy. Steer the president, steer the Congress, steer the legislatures in a fiscally sound and prudent manner. If they could, I'm sure they would have already done that. Now, I listen to the talk shows and I listen to the patriots, and the theme seems to be that if we can get enough information out there in front of the American people, they will rise up in holy, righteous indignation and throw the bad guys out, vote in a whole slate of new guys, and solve all of our problems. Boys and girls, we've been doing that now for 50 years. We have not voted any of the bad guys out. We have voted more of the bad guys in. If there were any good guys in, I think we've already voted them out. And the slate of office holders today are anything but the good guys, with the Patriot Act, Homeland Security, and budget deficits of $350 to $700 billion, and the lies that go with it, and the rampant bribery that comes out of the establishment in Washington from all of these special interests who all have their men on Capitol Hill, who are giving the senators and representatives vacations and money and cash and campaign contributions, which in the Bible it's called just gift giving, which is strictly prohibited. It's bribery. It's an endemic bribery. We used to have about 3,000 lobbyists here 20 years ago. Today we got 36,000 of these lobbyists running around Washington. Any concepts that you might have that Mr. Smith is going to Washington and straighten out the mess that's there, I think, is Alice in Wonderland rhetoric. Boys and girls, we are riding on the great ship America, which is headed toward destruction. There will be victims and there will be survivors. I think that it would be better for us to start preparing for survival rather than preparing for this utopian world of peace, peace, when there is no peace. Now let's see if we can take a look here at the hyperinflation in Germany in 1923 and learn a lesson. It's called the nightmare German inflation. It is the quintessential discussion of hyperinflation because Germany in 1921 through 23 experienced a hyperinflation that is the world's record. Nobody ever has gone through such an experience. I mentioned to you earlier, there was one woman mentioned in here. She sold her house for $15 billion, and in 6 months, it wouldn't buy a loaf of bread. Now, there are many parallels between the 1924 Germany and the present-day United States, and they are cause for concern. And we have not yet reached the depths to which Germany descended in that era. But few can look at the constant depreciation of our dollar since the early 1970s and then fail to be alarmed at it. It seems that we differ from 1924 Germany only in the duration between cause and effect. And while the German experience was compressed over a few short years, ours has been more protracted. I think this has occurred for two good reasons. First, American central bankers have learned enough from the German experience to delay and to extend the final consequences of printing too much fiat money. And second, Germany was a small state isolated from the rest of the world in pariah nation, or it was a pariah nation of sorts, and as a result, it had a difficult time finding a market for its government bonds. German deficits had to be financed internally, an impossibility which greatly accelerated the printing of fiat currency in Germany. Now, up until recently, the United States enjoyed a strong worldwide demand for its government bonds, so the negative effects of government deficits were subdued. But now, low interest rates and a growing fear among the G7 nations that the U.S. deficits are now out of control has greatly curtailed foreign bond purchases. And the Federal Reserve Bank has been forced to monetize an ever larger portion of our government debt as a result. This is the modern equivalent of printing money. So whether or not we're out of control seems to be a matter for debate. The trend, however, is very alarming. The largest deficit during the Nixon years was $23.4 billion. The largest deficit in the Ford presidency was $73.7 billion, President Reagan $221.2 billion, George Bush the first $290 billion, Bill Clinton $350 billion, and our present President Bush $450 billion, and the true number, $750 billion a year over the past 5 years. It is so bad, they don't even want to tell us any longer how bad it is. And they have removed the M3 report so that we will no longer know even how much money is being printed. So as this report points out, the correlation between deficits and inflation is sacrosanct. Deficits lead to inflation, and uncontrolled deficits lead to uncontrolled inflation. So whether or not there will be a nightmare America or American hyperinflation remains to be seen. But let it be said, though, that the trend is not favorable. And the survivors of the German debacle did so by purchasing gold and rare coins early in the process as a citizen. And as an investor, the best thing you can do is to prepare and then hope against hope that it doesn't happen here. This report of Germany's hyperinflation, originally published in 1970 by Scientific Market Analysis, could play an important part in that preservation process for you. There's little doubt that it's going to affect your thinking. Now, if history teaches us anything, it is that government cannot be trusted to manage our money. When currency is not redeemable in gold, its value depends entirely upon the judgment and upon the conscience of the politicians and the bankers. And that is the situation in our country today. Now, especially in an economic crisis or a war, such as the war in Iraq, the pressure to inflate becomes overwhelming. Any alternative may seem politically disastrous, whether it be the Roman emperors repeatedly debasing their coinage, or the French Revolutionary government printing a flood of assignats, John Law flooding France with debased money, or the Continental Congress issuing money until it was literally not worth a continental. Or, as John Adams said, they have printed money as plenty as oak leaves. A government in financial straits finds its easiest recourse is to issue more and more money until the money loses its value. The entire process is accompanied by a barrage of explanations, propaganda, and new regulations such as rationing and rent and price controls and wage controls, which hide the true situation from the eyes of most people until they have lost all of their savings. In World War I, Germany, like other governments, borrowed heavily to pay its war costs. This led to inflation, but not much more than in the United States during the same period. But after the war, there was a period of stability, but then the inflation resumed, and by 1923, the wildest inflation in the history of the world was raging, and often prices doubled in a few hours. A wild stampede developed to buy goods and to get rid of money. By late 1923, it took 200 billion marks to buy one loaf of bread. In July, it was 15 billion marks. By the end of the year, it was 200 billion marks to buy a loaf of bread. In January, a house sold for 15 billion marks. And millions of hard-working, thrifty German people found that their life's savings would not buy a postage stamp. They were penniless. How could this happen in a highly civilized nation run at the time by intelligent, democratically chosen leaders? What happened to business? What happened to wages and employment? How did some people manage to save their capital while a few speculators made fortunes? The years 1914 to 21 were pivotal, and when the war broke out in July of 1914, the Reichsbank, the German central bank, suspended redeemability of its notes in gold. After that, there was no legal limit as to how many notes it could print. That's what happened in the United States of America in 1933 after House Joint Resolution 192 was enacted. The government did not want to upset people with heavy taxes. Instead, it borrowed huge amounts of money, which were to be paid by the enemy after Germany had won the war. Much of the borrowing was discounted and monetized by the Reichsbank. As explained later, this amounted to issuing straight printing press money. That's precisely what President Bush presented to us before we attacked and invaded Iraq, that the war would be shortened to the point and that the costs of the war would be paid by the Iraqis with their oil revenues. But by the end of the war, the amount of money in circulation had increased fourfold, and in view of this, the extent of inflation was less than one might have expected. The Consumer Price Index had risen by 140% by December of 1918. This was equal to the inflation during the same time in England, a little more than the United States, but less than in France. And yet the floating debt of the Reichsbank had increased from 3 billion to 55 billion marks. Now in the United States, In 1988, we had $3 trillion in circulation. Today we have $9 trillion in circulation. So in 18 years, we have moved from 3 to 9 trillion. We have tripled the amount of money in circulation. And we're increasing that monetary flow at the rate of 12% per year, 1% a month. And why was inflation kept within bounds? Well, for the same reason that it got off to a slow start here in the United States during World War II. Necessities were rationed and luxury goods were not easily available. Millions of men were at the front and not in the market for goods. Civilians worked hard and had very little leisure or leisure time for spending. People saved money against peacetime in some cases to evade taxes. But the fuel for inflation was accumulating in the form of vast hoards of money. The harsh repatriation payments that were imposed upon Germany led the mark to depreciate against foreign currencies. And also the new democratic socialist leaders had promised the people all types of bounties. Increased wages, reduced hours, an expanded educational system, and new social benefits. But all of this meant a vastly increased demand on a limited production capacity. And here in the United States, while we are exporting our industrial base, which in 1960, 53% of the gross domestic product came from industry. Today it's down to 10%, and it is declining. And we have just imposed the most broad and wide sweeping new type social legislation, free drugs for the elderly under Medicare, under President Bush's watch. What the Germans did leading up to the war, during the war, and after the war is precisely what we Americans are doing prior to the war in Iraq, during the war in Iraq, and presumably after the war in Iraq comes to an end. That's why the Figge report is so dismal. Remember that leaders in South and Central America said, "Why are you Americans doing this to your economy? Why are you doing the very things that we did, which brought such disastrous consequences upon us? Haven't you learned anything from Bolivia, Argentina, Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, Hungary, Germany, China?" Boys and girls, people who cannot learn from history are then bound to repeat its mistakes. And we Americans have done precisely that. By February of 1920, this inflationary episode had run its course, and for the next 15 months, the price index held stable. The mark actually gained in value against foreign currencies, so that prices of imported goods fell by some 50%. We've been experiencing that. The dollar has been going up and down in value over the past 2-3 years. We're in that period of stability, but the stability, boys and girls, is about to come to an end. All right, let me remind you that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.